Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers everywhere. I'm Tim McNinch. I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary.
I'm Rosie Canethal, and I teach the Bible at Wake Forest University.
I'm Paul Essa. I am a PhD student in Hebrew Bible at Yale University.
And I'm Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University. We are continuing this week our Easter celebration texts in the Book of Revelation because we wanted to punish ourselves since there's no Hebrew Bible text in Easter. No, actually, it's been really enjoyable. It's been wonderful to see kind of this Hebrew Bible scholars read Revelation and come up with preaching tips out of it. So this week, we are in Revelation 7, 9 through 17. We've got some John text, Psalm 23, little known text that nobody's ever really heard of. Acts 9, who cares? We're mad about it because it replaces the First Testament text. So we are diving in with Revelation 7. And this is, again, one of those more common texts, in part because it shows up in the liturgy and in part because it's just one of those famous images. So,
And as you can tell, this is a party episode. We've got four of our co-hosts with you today to work through this apocalyptic text.
Lucky, lucky ducks. Yep.
How about we do the context, right?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues that we have with preaching the Book of Revelation is that so much of the book has been shucked right out of its literary and historical context. And one of the reasons that's really problematic in Revelation in particular is because there is actually a narrative to the book. There's a storyline, there's a plot, even though it's a very different type of plot than we're used to seeing in other literary works in the Bible. But if you pick something right out of its part in the plot and try to preach on it, you've probably missed a lot that's going on there. And more importantly, if you're trying to interpret it with all of this kind of dispensationalist stuff that we've talked about over the past few weeks, this idea that the Book of Revelation tells us what's going to happen at the end of time, you really get confused. Just a heads up, too, most of what I'm going to say today comes from Craig Koester. I think I talked about him a couple episodes ago, but his last name is K-O-E-S-T-E-R. And he's amazing. He's got several wonderful preaching books on Revelation and a huge Anchor Yale Bible commentary on the Book of Revelation. The other one I would recommend, I'm going to toss to Rosie because it is something by Sarah Emanuel, and she got to meet her. I did. So Dr. Sarah Emanuel was with Wake Forest University just on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And she was here talking about her book, Roasting Rome. And basically in that book, she treats the entire Book of Revelation as a satire against Rome. Hence the name Roasting Rome, which is also playing with this idea of hellfire, you know, and that kind of thing. So hopefully we'll, between Rachel and myself, we'll be weaving some of her insights as we talk about this passage. But my students really reacted in different ways, some, you know, but it definitely opened their eyes to the potential for how to use humor in these texts. And for preachers, this might be quite surprising to maybe look at a text in Revelation chapter 7 and be thinking about, well, what is it actually doing and how might it be inviting us to a kind of salvific laughter? And that is a lot of what Sarah Emanuel's work is about, too. It's so good. Salvific laughter, and I would say subversive laughter as well. A lot of what Emanuel does is talk about how making fun of an oppressive power is one of the ways to push back at the oppressive power when you don't have a whole lot of agency in around what you do.
Sounds very Bakhtinian.
Yeah, well, it does. Doesn't it? You just love bringing in Mikhail Bakhtin.
Yes,
that's right. He's your dude.
Well, and
to kind of play off of that, this idea of Rome as the oppressive power and so much of Revelation pushing back on the oppressive power is really the lens that one needs to have in mind when addressing chapter 6, which is the one right before chapter 7, because I'm good at math. The four horsemen of the apocalypse are what make up the majority of chapter 6. So, you know, if you're doing like a Bible study or really just asking anybody about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, they're going to have a pretty clear understanding of what they think it is. These four figures that are going to come and, you know, just wreak destruction on the earth at the end of time. The thing is, that's not really what's going on here in the book of Revelation, as long as you're thinking through it with that lens of what is this book doing to speak back against Rome as an oppressive power. What this chapter is doing is giving specific challenges to the audience of Revelation who think that the current social and economic conditions are their best security. Mm. Or another way to say this, and this is from Kester, the way things are is our salvation. Mm. This chapter points to the society's limits to be able to guarantee the well-being of its people. So each of the four horsemen are a challenge to something that people might be thinking is going to keep them safe or is going to keep them secure. So the first horseman is a conqueror. It's one who comes out conquering. If you're talking Rome, you don't have to reach far to understand what's going on there. Rome made things secure, quote unquote, by conquering. Mm-hmm. But the symbolism of this is a tribal figure. The rider holds a bow that wasn't common in the Roman army. The way the person is presented looks like a tribal warrior. And the tribes, the quote unquote barbarians, were the people outside Rome who weren't being conquered. So this is a challenge to military might. It's a reminder that societies who conquer can be conquered themselves. So you should not be trusting in your society's ability to conquer for your salvation. I won't run through each of them because the second horseman is a challenge to Pax Romana, he who takes peace. It's this idea that actually under what we call peace is violence simmering, because the way peace was achieved was just by pushing down on people until they stopped being so loud. The third horseman is about economics, challenging to those who thought that the economy was great. The economy had never been better, because at this time there were also food shortages. So the economy had never been better for the 1%, but for most people, it was really not very good at all. And then the fourth horseman, my favorite, is death, because death comes for everyone. I mean, it's just sort of this blanket, like, mic drop. You know what I mean? Like, you think everything's great? Well, guess what? Death comes for you, too. And it doesn't matter how much societal or economic power you've had. But what's interesting is that it doesn't end there. So we're walking through the seals right now on this edict that God put forth, and Jesus is breaking the seals. And each time he breaks a seal, part of the message comes forth. That you would think that the fourth seal is sort of like that mic drop, like, okay, that's it. There's nothing bigger than that. The fifth seal is actually martyrs. And one of the things that is so interesting about that is because martyrs represent injustice, which is the greatest challenge to the way things are, even above death, because it's the voices of the victims who show that all is not well, even when society wants you to think it's so. So really briefly, I'm almost to the end. There's the sixth seal, which is just kind of saying that everybody, God's going to hold everybody accountable for their sins, and all creation cries out because they know nobody can stand before God's righteous judgment. Then the whole reason I'm telling you all of this is because you can feel the momentum building, right? Like you get to this point in the chapter, you think, okay, everything is going, you know, God is going to judge everything now. We're going to have cosmic judgment. But right before that point, there is a pause. And that's all of chapter 7. John, at this point, changes tactics completely. Instead of using the law to motivate us, if you're talking about gospel, you know, law, gospel in terms of Lutheran theology, the law is paused and is switched to gospel. And that's where we enter into chapter 7. And there's this idea that every time Revelation brings you to your knees, it also immediately then brings you up to the throne room to stand before God and to see the hope to which God is calling you, and not just the judgment that God is levering at you as well. So that's some of the context that brings us to this chapter 7. And I think that's important because, taken out of context, chapter 7 sounds like it's all going to be happy. You know, that's all we need to do. And it's like, I don't know. Like, yes, but things are really wrong right now. And God wants you to come face to face with what's really wrong before getting to the dessert, if you will, in chapter 7.
I think for the most part, you know, you draw us. So at this point, we are at the throne room, right? And I think chapter 7 begins with this grand throne room imagery where we have like a people from all over the place, described as like ethically multicultural, internationally multicultural, and they're before the throne. And what they do, I think, for the most part, piggybacks back on the sort of great context that you're giving us in chapter 6, which is they proclaim in one voice that salvation belongs to God.
Yeah, right.
Which for me sounds like it's worship, but it also sounds a little protesty for me. It's like protest with some kind of a worship with it, because it's like, at the end of the day, the big question is, who really has power? Is it God or the emperor? Right?
Yes.
So although it's like, you know, salvation belongs to God, within it is also like, we cannot trust the systems of today for salvation or for any kind of redemption, but God alone, right? So it's still counter-imperial plus like throne room, glory build, worship, you know, imagery.
Absolutely. That's a great point. I think it's one thing, I'm kind of fresh from Dr. Emmanuel's talk, so I'm just kind of thinking through one of the things that she was saying and that I credit her for, which is that this imperial imagery, though, has a way of turning itself around on even the lamb, right? Because what's happening is we're still getting an imitation of the same violence of the that's being critiqued of Rome, right? So chapter 7 begins with four angels holding back the four corners of the earth and the four winds, right? Mm-hmm. And another angel saying, don't damage the earth or the sea or the tree, right? So there's clearly a violence that is coming that's being held back in this moment, right? And I think I'm thinking also of Esther Homori's idea of like the monsters of God, and these angels are not comforting. These are violent angels who are holding back destruction upon the earth, right? Revelation has so much violence in the text, right? And so, I mean, even as we kind of carve out in our liturgical reading, you know, Rachel, you're saying something that might be tempted to just kind of see the triumph in it.
That's right, yeah.
At the edges of the scene is a barely held together violence that is coming for the earth and its inhabitants and all of that. And the one responsible for that is the one on the throne. Is our imagination so limited by the kind of imperial formation that we've received, you know, living within a dominant power, that even Christian imagination is kind of circumscribed by worldly power, by what we've seen, right? And that's one of the kind of things that Dr. Emmanuel talks about when she's talking about Revelation, is like, here's the satire, but in the end, the satire seems to redound in a surprising way to its own author, right? So, I mean, this is like a longer kind of conversation about how violence begets violence, but...
I mean, I think it makes me think of, I think in Audre Lorde, the master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house. You know, I think it sounds silly, but like violence is never the answer, right? I would want to say too as well that like we are talking about a text that's 2,000 years old. So coming at it from a very different, you know, I think anything post the atom bomb, you know, we have to think differently about violence, because our violence now can actually destroy the world.
Right. And even before we get to this passage, we haven't even hit the core, right? Our chapter 7, 9 to 17, we're still at the kind of liminal edge of this, but like we hear a roll call, right? So that's the kind of thing. And that is a military roll call, right? So the number of those who were sealed, that's what they're pausing the destruction for. That's what the angel has come down and say, don't destroy yet. Make sure that these 144,000, again, that number, highly symbolic, 12 times 12, tribes, the fullness.
Right?
Yeah. And then 100 times 100,000, right? So like something innumerable and not...
To the nth degree.
Like, to the nth degree.
This is the Bible trying to say to the nth degree.
Right. Mm-hmm. You cannot number this, but also there's a fullness in it, 12 times 12, right? Mm-hmm. So then we get this, but then we get this roll call of these 12 tribes. And as I was reminding my undergrads, right, the historical context, these tribes don't exist, right? I mean, back in 722, those kind of lost 10 tribes, quote unquote, you know, they're not lost, they're dispersed and assimilated. But these tribes are such a nostalgia to be repeating these names somewhere in the, you know, end of first century, early second century.
what are we roll calling here?
Yeah.
You know, it to me is a little astounding. It's like, who is lining up? Who are these tribes? Who are these 12,000, this fullness upon fullness?
Mm.
And then we kind of get into our passage, right? And there we get this idea of every nation, every tribe, every
yeah.
time certain. So not just maybe these 12, but a symbol it's, of something.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Something.
Yeah.
You can't even map, right? As we're talking yeah. about like what this imagination might be,
yeah.
but like
yeah.
so vast and so diverse and like, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some debate in the literature, I think, over whether the 144,000 here are a different group from the multitudes from every tribe and people and nation and language,
mm-hmm.
Or whether it's kind of like this, these two kind of sitting over on top of each other as two mm-hmm. pictures of the same community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, as with many things in Revelation, it's probably impossible to resolve that.
It's a sniper, yeah.
It's such, it's so suggestive in its imagery that it's hard to yeah. just sort of nail down this means that and this means that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more suggestive. Like so much in the book is suggestive and implied. But if you take both of those interpretations, I think they both have something really beautiful to offer. If you assume they're two different groups, then you could see the sort of naming of these lost tribes, the roll call, as you said, Rosie, of like, who even are these people, as the impossible fulfillment of God's promise to Israel. You know, like it's not even possible anymore to roll call those tribes because they're so dispersed. And yet here we see it, like it's happening. So I see this as sort of like one way to interpret it is this impossible fulfillment of God's promise. And then this explosion of it, this expansion
yeah.
of it from Israel to all of these tribes and nations and all this kind of stuff. And I think there's some really beautiful preachable theology there. But if you also take what you were saying, Tim, about these two images overlapping each other, then all of a sudden the whole world is encompassed in Israel. And that is also both fulfillment and expansion at the same time. And that's a really beautiful image mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. In any case, it's part of a thread that runs through all of Revelation of the anchoring of this vision and of the imagination of this author in their Jewishness.
Yeah.
So this is, it's helpful to remind folks that what we're reading here is ancient Jewish literature.
Yeah.
Yep.
Just
yeah.
as, you know, the Hebrew Bible is, just as all of the New Testament is, this
yeah.
is ancient Jewish literature. And the Jewish quality of it comes to the surface at many points in Revelation, including explicit places like this listing of the tribes of Israel
yeah.
as being preserved and reconstituted, but also in just the author of this text is soaked
yeah.
in their Bible.
Yeah,
yeah right.
There are so many
right.
references, both direct quotes and allusions to the Hebrew Bible.
Yep.
They knew it inside and out. And when they were interpreting their sense of a vision of what they had experienced here, it erupted onto the page in biblical language, which is really an amazing thing.
Mm.
Well, and I would point out, too, that like when you say Bible, Tim, you really mean Hebrew Bible. Like there's not quotations mm-hmm. of Paul here. There's not quotations of the Synoptic Gospels. Like this, it's really appropriate to think of this as Jewish literature because their consideration of, I mean, obviously Jesus is there, but their consideration of the Bible is, you know, the Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So did anyone, I didn't think to look up the references, but there's
I have something I can read a few things. So so what I'm thinking here is like the sort of global understanding of this like multicultural people perhaps makes references to Isaiah 2 and Isaiah 49. Mm. There is also something about the robes and the washing of the robes with the blood, which I think is like maybe Isaiah 1 and then Psalm 51. There are some connections with that as well. I also found that Psalm 23 has something to do with the shepherd language and the lamb
for sure.
language. The divine shelter language towards the end in verse 15, perhaps Isaiah 4 or Psalm 27.
Oh, so many of the Psalms, yeah.
So many of the Psalms, yeah.
But to that point, that word shelter in Greek is actually like that word that when John talks about Jesus dwelling with us, right? That idea.
Mm-hmm.
But that points back to the idea of the tabernacle, right?
Yeah.
So all of that is being, so to this point about this imagery being soaked, like I kind of was struck by that. The one who's seated on the throne will shelter them. But that word, skenose, is pointing back to the tent tabernacle back in the Hebrew, yeah. kind of like basic. Oh. So it takes this alpha and omega that Revelation really does try to, you know, from end to end, it really does through all this language, right? So, you know, you're pointing out Isaiah 49. That's literally quoted, right? So in the poetry that's here toward the latter end of this, when they're saying the one who is seated on the throne will shelter them, and it goes into they will hunger no more and thirst no more. The sun will not strike them, nor any scorching heat. Straight from Isaiah chapter 49, verse 10. The second servant song of second Isaiah that we in our podcast we've talked about a lot is addressing the exiles, and this language is being recycled here, like literally being lifted up and you know, kind of resituated now with the Lamb, this kind of image that also is so deeply invested in the Hebrew Bible. Like the Lamb, the Passover Lamb, the palm branches that are being used, you know. These are this is part of the ceremony, part of another liturgy that we're literally witnessing with the people giving worship.
Another intertextual connection that I found really fascinating is back in Isaiah 4, where there's a paragraph there about the survivors of Zion, the ones who have persisted through the great tribulation, in a sense, if we're using Revelation's language. Here's just a couple lines from that, starting in verse 2. On the day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be the pride and glory of the survivors of Israel. So here's like a picture of that 144,000, right? Whoever is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who's been recorded for life in Jerusalem, once the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from its midst, by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning. Then here's the part that really resonated. The Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over its places of assembly a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of flaming fire by night. Indeed, over all the glory there will be a canopy. It will serve as a pavilion, a shade by day from the heat and refuge and shelter from the storm and rain. So there's that picture of when God's salvation comes for Israel and the world, it creates this place of shelter and safety that's pictured again here in Revelation 7.
Even the tears language, right? The wipe every tear from their eyes and from all of their faces. I think Isaiah 25, it's a direct quote, I think. Isaiah 25 verse 8 2 says, then the Lord God would wipe away the tears from all their faces and the disgrace of his people. It would take away from all the earth. But the Lord has spoken. Right. So this is deeply, like you said, Tim, like this writer is deeply, deeply, deeply embedded in the Hebrew Bible. I wanted to say something about the people who are robed in white, who have come to the throne, and a person asks, where are they from? And he says, sir, only you know. And then the response that is giving is that these are those who have come out of the great ordeal, right? I kept thinking about that line. Who are these multicultural, white-robed, international people? They are the people who have survived the great ordeal. And I didn't look up the Greek, but I thought immediately about, like, you know, the sort of imperial context in which this text is from. And martyrdom, probably, maybe imprisonment, maybe persecution, maybe some kind of oppression. And at the end of this passage, the way the Lamb who is on the throne is washing their clothes, and the imagery of hope and sort of revival and restoration. Of course, it's delayed justice. It's still not, you know, arrived yet, but at least they can foresee themselves getting there. And they've been able to craft a narrative that sort of uplifts them from the current situation in which they are, right? So the great people of ordeal, like, it's, you know, it's, for me, I think it resonates also with the message of hope.
The concept of this great ordeal which is sometimes translated tribulation as well. This is not exclusive to Revelation in apocalyptic literature. There's a sense that before God's glorious rectifying of everything happens, there will be a period of intense trouble and suffering. In Hebrew, it's the term tzara, like dire straits, oppression.
Distress.
Yeah, distress. And Paul's doing his exam, so he's right on top of the heap.
It's all fresh, man. It's all fresh.
So Daniel 12 is a good example of that, where just before God brings the culmination of what Daniel's hoping for, there's a period of great distress. Although God preserves those who are meant to endure through. Mm-hmm. Another example is Ezekiel 9. There's the great judgment of God is going to come, but before that happens, those who are meant to be preserved are marked with a mark on their foreheads, just as here in Revelation 7. So there's a sense, I think, for those who would have received this book of Revelation, that in spite of the great pressure, the distress that you feel, the tribulation that you're enduring, that's not the last word. Right? There's a future that's coming that's going to put things right, and God will have marked you for preservation through even this ordeal.
I think that's so important. And I think that we misunderstand and we misconstrue that, because it's so often like Left Behind series, it's presented as things are fine now, like in our current present moment, and then they're going to get really, really bad, and then it's going to be the end of time. And we have to remember that this, all apocalyptic literature is written for communities in turmoil and trauma to help them interpret their turmoil and trauma, their current moment. So, like, it's not even this sense that, like, it's coming in the future. It's that for these communities, it was happening right now. And exactly what you said, Tim, it's not the last word. God's hope and God's power will overcome. And that, of course, brings us to, you know, back to Rosie and Sarah Emanuel, which is that imagery, that imperial imagery of conquering and overcoming. And, you know, there's problems with that for sure. But just for people who are thinking about this, that the time of turmoil and trauma hasn't happened yet and we're waiting for it, that's not what apocalyptic literature is doing. It's not predicting that. It's helping interpret it for people who are undergoing it right now.
Yeah. And again, I think it comes back to a big question, which is, in apocalyptic literature, what is justice and how does it look like?
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, it's not realized. It's the reason why the entire literature exists is because we don't have it yet, right?
Yeah.
It's delayed. It's deferred.
Yeah.
The restoration that was promised is not yet here. And we're trying to understand why it's not yet here. And the way to make sense of it is to defer it to cosmology. It's going to come, and we need to hold on, and we need to. And for people, just in case you're curious about what the present situation looks like, I feel like the last few verses sort of gives us a clue, right? There's something about hunger. There's something about thirst. There's something about bad weather. There's something about tears, and, you know, and all the things that people face in dire situations. And I think it's horrible, but, you know, it's also impressive that even in the midst of situations like this, they are able to sort of envision it to come future that is different from the current situation. I think that's the powerful thing about apocalypticism.
Wow, I just love this book so much. It rival the Psalms for you, Rachel.
I mean, it's probably my New Testament bestie. The Psalms are my OT bestie, and the Revelation is my New Testament bestie. Yeah, I love it. I really do. It's my jam. So
we've gotten into a lot of the depth here. How would we angle this conversation into some down to, you know, brass tacks tips for preaching for preachers who might be taking up this text?
Yeah. I'm wondering if people could use the lens, no pun intended, of perspective as a preaching angle. So again, remember that this is a vision that, you know, the whole book, but also this in particular at the beginning of chapter 7, after this, I saw. It's a vision. What the visions are in the book of Revelation are meant to be a gift. They're meant to help you change the way you see your present circumstances so that you change your behavior. Mm-hmm. There's this both interpretation and action cycle. Maybe I should do it this way. There we go. Interpretation and action cycle that's meant to be a constant loop going throughout Revelation. And then we live that cycle in our lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, just from a practical standpoint, preachers, one of the things you can say is how you read the book of Revelation changes what you get out of it. Are you reading it for signs of the end of the world? Then guess what? You'll find signs of the end of the world. If you're reading it, though, for insight into God's character and insight into your calling and vocation and how you live that out with justice and hope in the midst of these really difficult times, you're going to find that as well. So I think the angle is coming out of this text. It's meant to give us a perspective. And, you know, there's ableism in this image. I'm very well aware of that. But, you know, if you put on these glasses that God is offering you, how does it change the way you see your life? How is that gospel and good news to give you signs of the water of life everywhere and people who are so thirsty and hungering for it and what you're called to do in the midst of that? So I think perspective could be a really interesting angle to use when preaching this text.
Mm. I like it. Who else has something?
I think for me, I always come at this in the liturgical moment, right? So we're at the fourth Sunday of Easter, which is, you know, a little past midway. We've got six Sundays for Easter. And in the wisdom of the kind of church calendar, the idea is that you need those 50 days to absorb the message of Easter, that you don't just get it on Easter Sunday, that you need these Sundays to slowly unfold. I'm at the fourth Sunday of Easter, and all of these readings are reminding me about sheep and shepherd. Yeah. And this, the invitation that Psalm 23 offers to hear the voice of the Lamb, to be nourished by the green grass, to come by these waters. And the kind of unfolding gift of Easter life is one that I am kind of, you know, in the midst of as I read this story. I mean, we begin with Acts chapter 9, Peter imitating Jesus in raising this woman named Dorcas, a widow who's like known for good deeds, who passed away and then suddenly is back alive again, right? Yeah. I mean, Psalm 23, you know, that infamous psalm that we all kind of can think of. And then we get to this Revelation passage and we see the Lamb on the throne. And then finally, John chapter 10, my sheep hear my voice, you know? So to me, I'm like, what am I hearing, you know, in the midst of this? For many of us, we might be thinking we're living in apocalypse, right? And for some of us, maybe we are. We're living in a sense of like, this is the end of time. How could it get worse than this? Ecological disasters around us. Chapter 7 starts off with like this idea that ecological disasters are right around the corner. You know, so there, both then and now, apocalyptic literature, you know, allows us to approach disaster, which apparently never ends. Right? I mean, there's no end to the number of disasters that, you know, we as a collective need to be able to face. But once again, Easter is also about renewing, you know, a sense of hope. Uncertainty of Easter is that, you know, how are these disciples to live, you know, without the kind of walking Jesus? They are now taking on leadership, right? I mean, which is crazy. We've just read about the disciples. Don't want them in charge. How is that going to work, right? Here we are, fourth Sunday of Easter, and we're looking around in our pews. These are our brothers and sisters. This is the multitude. Yeah. Every generation, every language, ability, right? I mean, to me, that's the Easter miracle, right? Is that you just look around and you're like, what the hell are we doing here? Who's in charge?
That's so beautiful.
I kept thinking along the same lines of shepherd and lamb, you know, and thinking about how Easter presents the lamb as the one that was slain. Mm. I think it's also in Revelations too, as the one who was slain, of course, died and resurrected alive and among us. But here the lamb is at the center of the throne and he will be the shepherd of the people, the shepherd of the scattered people, the persecuted people, the gathered people before the throne, and would lead them to the springs of the water of life and will wipe away every tear and every sorrow from their eyes. And I think that's powerful because for me, the lamb who was slain had experienced his own wounds and his own tears and pain and suffering by himself. Yeah. And so he guiding to the springs of the water of life and wiping every tear is powerful because he's experienced it and knows what it feels and has been there and can go through it with everyone else experiences suffering, including in this imperial context where people are heavily persecuted. So I think the imagery of the shepherd, where the lamb is becoming the shepherd or is the shepherd, I think it's a very powerful one, and I'll stick with that.
I almost don't want to add anything to these beautiful ideas that have come from the three of you. And what I will say is this whole lamb becoming the shepherd thing, I can't hear that without thinking of Shaun the Sheep. Like there's this lamb who is not just walking around in the field going, "Mah," but is actually like super smart and is leading the sheep in the way that the shepherd should be. You know, one of the sheep, you know, the lamb is becoming the shepherd. And I wonder if that image was, you know, I don't, if this is all kind of satirical, perhaps. There's some humor in the image of a lamb becoming the shepherd.
Yeah.
So there's something there.
Yeah.
The thing I keep coming back to, salvation belongs to our God.
Yeah.
Seated on the throne and to the lamb.
I know.
So this lamb is getting like this CV, this resume of leadership, and
he's up for tenure. He's up for tenure, basically.
That's right. That's right. And inspires this kind of praise, this sevenfold blessing that gets repeated here.
Yeah.
Like this lamb is worth paying attention to.
Mm.
And as we were talking about the way that the power of empire asserts that it owns salvation, that it is the path towards salvation. This is protesting that. It's saying, no, salvation belongs to God and to this lamb, who is our shepherd.
Yep.
And that, I think that is an Easter message for sure.
And I think that's where you can pull in that literary context of chapter 6, because that's the really big critique of the society, which wants you to think it's got salvation in its hands. And that's such a lie. And that's what chapter 7 is pushing back towards. So if you're going to take that angle, preachers, pull in a little bit of that four horsemen of the apocalypse and run with them too.
Indeed.
Well, that's a whole lot for us to chew on. Some really great insights into the context that leads us to Revelation chapter 7, and then all sorts of insights into how this is connected to the world of the Hebrew Bible, but also says something very specific into the experiences of those who have been going through trauma and oppression in a moment in the ancient world or in our own moment. So thank you all for sticking around with us here to party with us in this party episode.
We know how to party.
That's right. That's right. All of our back episodes are available on our YouTube channel, but also on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. You can contact us to let us know what you think of what we're doing at our email, firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on Apple or Spotify or all of those places.
Just anywhere. Just leave a note on the curb and we'll find
it. That's right.
We'll find it.
Just say something to a stranger. They'll get the message to us.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we're enjoying this Revelation series and it's not done yet. So come back and join us next week. Until then, I'm Tim McNinch.
I'm Rachel Wren. I'm Rosie Candlefull.
And I'm Paul Issa. Happy preaching.
Happy preaching.
Hey, Barry, I'm going to send y'all a link. Oh my goodness. I can't believe it.